Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It is the Disruption Zone, and I want to bring on a very special guest right now. His name is Dr. Paul Saladino. He is also known on Instagram and Twitter as the Carnivore MD. And Dr. Saladino, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on. I'm super excited to be here.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is you are not like a lot of other doctors, and I mean that as a compliment, by the way, because you've kind of been in this sort of paleo slash carnivore slash keto world and become very well known for that. And before we get into the issue of the coronavirus, I kind of want to let people know a little bit of your background on that. You're basically carnivore right now, but you at one time were a vegetarian, and it made you pretty sick, didn't it?
I was raw vegan. So I've had a long journey through diet, and I've always been fascinated by diet and the way that food affects us. I think that this concept won't be foreign to the listener. Food is a huge, huge lever in health and disease, and I've had that suspicion and that inclination for many, many years. And I've been experimenting with my own diet now for over a decade, and most of that was driven by my own autoimmune issues. I had eczema that was pretty severe. I had asthma, and I always had the suspicion, the sense that my autoimmunity, my body's reaction against itself, was driven by something in my diet. And perhaps for some people, the idea that a food could affect your immune system negatively is a radical concept, but I think it's becoming more and more mainstream that a lot of the issues that we face as humans today, a lot of chronic disease, what kills us in 2020 is related to food choices. And that will probably not be very surprising for people, but that's where I've been for many, many years, is thinking about diet, thinking about where humans get the nutrients that we need and how diet can affect our immune system in a positive or negative way.
How did you get into carnivore?
So I was a raw vegan about, I'm going to say 12 or 13 years ago, and I lost a lot of weight. I had eczema at the time. It got worse when I was a vegan, and I lost 25 to 30 pounds of muscle. So not good weight, not fat. Wow. I lost 30 pounds of muscle. So when I say I lost weight, I lost the good kind of, I lost the weight that you don't want to lose.
Right.
I got to be extremely skinny, and eventually after 6 or 7 months had energy issues and probably had some mood issues kind of crop up, a little depression perhaps on the diet. After that, I had heard some people talk about kind of paleo diets, which is just this idea that the way we eat now should be informed by the way that our ancestors have eaten in the past. Paleo refers to Paleolithic, which is a period of time in human history, a Paleolithic period. How did people eat them? We can't know for sure. We don't have a time machine, but we can reconstruct it based on what we know with ethnographic, archaeologic, and anthropologic evidence.
Right.
So I got interested in which foods were perhaps discordant with our ancient genetics, which haven't changed that much. It's a whole separate discussion about how quickly genetics will change in response to a food. But I got interested in that, added meat back into my diet in addition to plants, and felt better, gained a lot of muscle back, but continued to have my autoimmune issues of eczema and probably a little bit of underlying, I don't know what to call it, just I didn't even know that I had, anxiety or depression or any psychiatric issue until I went carnivore, but that came much later. So most of what I experienced was, autoimmune issues, eczema and asthma, these type of things, maybe a little bit of sleep disturbance from here and there. And I just thought, man, I'm eating the best diet I can. I'm eating almost entirely organic animals and plants, and I'm still having eczema. I'm still having some breathing issues from time to time. And the more I looked into it, the more I realized that the whole point of a Paleolithic diet is to cut out the most toxic plant foods and to cut out milk for some people if that's not a very ancestral food. But the main things you cut out on a paleo diet are grains and beans in addition to dairy,
right,
thinking, oh, our ancestors didn't eat a lot of foods. Well, the reason you cut out grains and beans on a paleo diet is because those are plant seeds that have digestive enzyme inhibitors. People will be familiar with gluten and other lectins, carbohydrate binding proteins in grains. But the concept that grains and beans on a paleo diet could be harmful for us is not totally foreign.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you expand that lens and you pull it out further, you think, well, what about nuts and seeds? Couldn't those have toxins too? Because those are plant seeds. And in fact, they do. They have digestive enzyme inhibitors. They have phytic acid. They have oxalates. They don't want to get eaten. Then you pull back further and you start to think, well, wait a minute. What if the seeds of a plant are not the only part of a plant that's defended against predation by animals? Wouldn't the leaves be defended? What about the bark? What about the stems? What about the roots? And when you really dig into it, what you realize, or what I began to realize, was that it's so intuitive when you think about it. Plants don't want to get eaten. Animals don't want to get eaten either, but animals can run away or kick you or bite you.
Right.
But
or eat you.
Plant is, yeah, they can eat you. But a plant is stuck in the ground. It's not mobile. The only defense that a plant has against animals eating it is to put something, some chemical, either a physical spike or a chemical spike into its leaves and bark and roots to kind of further this chemical warfare, this chemical arms race that's been going on between insects and fungi and animals and plants for 450 million years. So that was the beginning of my carnivore thinking, or the thinking around the plant foods was, wow, when I expanded the lens, there were a lot of toxins in plants. And the more plants I cut out, the better I felt. And then eventually, when I removed all plants from my diet, my eczema went away completely. My mood improved. And I thought, this is wild. I need to dig into this more. And thus began my carnivore journey. I wrote a book about it called The Carnivore Code, which people can check out. It's a very detailed look into plant toxins. It's a look into all the anti-nutrients in plants. It's a look into anthropology. And it's a look into why we've been misled about meat when we're told that it's not good for us. This ancestral food that is so nourishing, we've been told it's not good for us. So anyway, that's what the book is about.
Well,
that was my journey to it.
I was going to say, one thing I want to say about the book, too, is that it gets 4 stars with a ton of reviews on Amazon. That's hard to do.
Oh, that's 5 stars.
I'm sorry, five stars.
Sorry,
I miscounted.
5-star
reviews. I miscounted that.
5 stars on Amazon.
Yeah, 5 stars on Amazon with a ton of reviews. And that's kind of hard to do, especially given how hard you're going against the grain of the industrial food complex. You know what I mean? It's like, that is an accomplishment that, you know, it's selling, not the book's not only selling well, but that people are reading it and they're going, that makes sense. You know? So
there's over 90%. I think there were 91% 5-star reviews on Amazon. There's almost 400 reviews. The book has only been out for 2 months.
Right.
It's a pretty good, the book has sold a lot of copies. It's sold a lot of copies so far. Yeah, it's great.
I want to, and
there definitely are vegan trolls making reviews against the book,
right,
on Amazon as well.
Yeah.
There's a couple of 1-star reviews from people that didn't even read the book.
Of course. That's the way it works.
Yeah.
Now, what is your, before we get into COVID, and I just want to make sure, because I want people to understand who you are and where you're coming from. That's kind of why I wanted to begin with this, to build the conversation. You're a medical doctor. You're not a guy who went and got just a PhD. You did your residency at some really respected medical places. I think Washington State was one of the places that you did your medical residency. Also, you in California as well, correct?
I did my residency at the University of Washington.
Okay, yeah.
In Seattle.
Yep.
And I went to medical school at the University of Arizona. And yeah, I'm an MD, so I'm a medical doctor.
Right.
I'm board certified. You know, 4 years of medical school, 4 years of residency, postgraduate training. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
I just wanted people to know that it's not like we picked up the, you know, I mean, a lot of people in the paleo community that, which I'm a member of, know about you, but people outside of that are like, you know, I don't want them to think that you're just a guy with a PhD. You're a medical doctor. And I think that's an important thing to establish, because as we kind of go into this next stage of the conversation, but before we do, when you say carnivore, what is a day's diet like? I mean, are you 100%, or do you eat some berries? I know there's like some debate in the carnivore community about whether certain things like that are allowed. What is your dietary status with that?
Yeah, so right now I don't eat any plant foods, but I do think that plant foods exist on a spectrum of toxicity.
Right.
And that people in the book, in the Carnivore Code, and which is out now, and the cookbook, which I'm writing for the fall, I do talk about a spectrum of plant toxicity. I think a lot of people are going to be able to eat some plants.
Right.
And that the biggest lever, the most improvement will probably come not from eliminating all plants, but maybe from eliminating the most toxic plants. And I talk about that in the book and help people understand what the most toxic plants are. Personally, I've found that I don't have to include any plants in my diet. I think it's easier that way. So all of what I eat are animal foods. I have occasionally tried to reintroduce things like squash or berries or avocado, foods that I think are less toxic plant foods. And they're okay. I don't end up craving them afterward, and I don't feel like they're missing when I don't have them. But I think that there is a possibility to include those foods. I don't do it more than once every few months that I might have a few berries just because someone I'm eating with has berries or I'm sharing them with someone. But it's pretty rare.
Right.
So I would say 99.8% of my diet is animal foods and has been for the last 2 years. I will mention that I have started eating honey recently. Okay. So I've been experimenting with raw organic honey. I think there are ways to do a carnivore diet that are low carb and ways to do a carnivore diet that include carbohydrates, depending on the goals of the athlete, the goals of the individual, et cetera. A lot of people do carnivore diets. They are ketogenic, they're low carb, but I think honey is a fascinating substance that is, you know, it's the nectar of a flower that's fermented in a bee's stomach. Is it a plant food? Is it an animal food? Like, it's not really a plant that's in the ground. So honey does have many compounds in it, but I think that it's going to have a lot less plant defense chemicals than a tree or a leaf or a grass or, you know, one of those type of plant foods.
Well, it seems logical because, you know, we eat animals because we need the nutrients that plants have, but the animals have the capability of processing those nutrients where we might not do it as well. And therefore, it makes sense. Same thing with honey. Why did you center in on honey? Why that? Was it for the taste, or was it because you wanted some extra carbs, or what was the reason for that?
I wanted to experiment with carbohydrates. As I went further and further down the carnivore rabbit hole, as I've gone down, I've realized, you know, like all the plant foods I study, they all have something that's trying to dissuade animals from eating them. That's pretty clear. And so I thought, well, I think humans probably ate plants evolutionarily, mostly as survival food and maybe in a pinch when they couldn't get animals. But the one piece of the carnivore equation that I got curious about was ketones, I think, are very common in our bodies. Ketogenic states are probably common and have been ancestrally common.
Right.
But is there some benefit to occasionally having carbohydrates? Would our ancestors have eaten fruit occasionally? Probably when it was seasonal. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, let me see how it feels to go in and out of ketosis, to eat all animal foods one day with no carbs, to include some carbs the next day. And it's been an ongoing experiment the last few months. I've done a continuous blood glucose monitor, watched my blood glucose responses with honey. And to be honest, I think I just feel, I like the way I feel cycling in and out of ketosis.
Right.
Rather than being in ketosis 100% of the time for years and years at a time. But I think it's very individual. And if people feel good in ketosis 100% of the time, I think that humans probably spent a lot of time in ketosis evolutionarily. Well, carbs are pretty rare in the wilderness.
It makes sense when you think about Paleo Man that he would have probably at some point stumbled over a beehive, gotten a little bit of honey on his hands, licked it off and gone, damn, that's good.
That's real good.
You know what I mean?
That's real good.
So it's the same thing with fruits. And I actually heard, it might have been your podcast with L. Russ on the Primal Blueprint. I can't remember exactly, but somebody was talking about how like a blueberry is probably not as toxic as a lot of other plants because that's the fruit that the tree has borne, so to speak. The bush has borne that. It's not, when you eat the blueberry, you're not eating the bush, you know. So it's like, that maybe there's a little less toxicity in the fruit itself, and that might make sense why at least seasonally we would have eaten them as we came across them. Plus, most of the vegetables we eat today are nothing like what we would have seen when we were in that state as well.
Exactly. But I think fruit is much less toxic, and that gets into the rabbit holes, which we probably don't have time to go down today, regarding fructose and whatnot. But I think fruit is much less toxic, and at least if we can anthropomorphize plants a little bit, you think, plants are making fruit, so animals will consume it. They're not trying to poison the animals.
Right.
But how often do you see birds, you know, eating the fruit of a plant, but they're not eating the vine, they're not eating the leaves. You know, a bird is not going to eat a raspberry vine. They're going to eat the raspberries because they understand that, hey, this is not as toxic. This red thing is not as toxic as this green thing. A bird could just go up to there's nothing stopping a bird from eating a leaf or a vine on a raspberry, you know, vine or a blackberry patch, you know, but that's not what they eat. Animals don't really eat those things. The bear won't eat the raspberry bush. They'll eat the raspberries, et cetera, et cetera. Same with blueberries. They realize, hey, part of this plant is a little different. And I think that's pretty intuitive to people that the fruit is going to be less toxic. Now, the question is how much fruit, how often should we eat it? We're still trying to understand that, but I think that there are more and less toxic parts of plants.
Makes sense. Now, I want to tell people to go to your website, CarnivoreMD. Also, your book is available there. It's also available on Amazon.com. And anybody who's had their curiosity piqued about this medical doctor who's talking about eating only meat, buy the book because it's fascinating. And what I love about what you do, and this is what, you know, I had a major health issue that led me to paleo, and I first, you know, found Mark Sisson. And the reason why I respected him so much was because, unlike a lot of other hype people out there, he's not a hype person. He was doing science. And that's why I was drawn to you when you came on the Primal Blueprint. I was like, this guy knows the science. You're a doctor who cares about people's lives and nutrition, and you're studying it. And people should see what you look like too, by the way. You're a daggone athletic specimen. So you're not, you know, you're walking the walk and talking the talk. Real quick though, before COVID, do you season your meat at all? I mean, do you put anything on it at all to flavor it, or do you just eat it straight up?
I use Redmond Real Salt.
So I love that stuff.
I like a good mineral salt.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, so let's talk COVID-19. Obviously, as a doctor, you're very intensely interested in this. And I've been watching your Twitter on this, and it's pretty fascinating. One of the things that you've been really trying to do is to pound into people's heads. My wife pointed out to me today that the World Health Organization said, hey, guys, probably shouldn't drink too much alcohol because it weakens your immune system. Why does it weaken your immune system? Well, because it's mostly grains and carbs. That's how it's made. And they failed to make the connection between sugar in our body and the immune system. But it's almost like some of our healthcare professionals are dancing around this fact that we know. And yet America is struggling in certain areas where we have high rates of obesity, high rates of chronic disease, which, as you pointed out, are directly tied to our dietary habits in this country.
Exactly. I mean, the American Diabetes Association has a huge campaign now to raise awareness of the increased risk that people with type 2 and type 1 diabetes have with serious complications of coronavirus, like developing COVID-19, which is what we call the disease of coronavirus. Now, that's great. That's fantastic that the American Diabetes Association is raising that awareness. But the very real fact of the matter is that type 2 diabetes is reversible. Mm-hmm. Type 2 diabetes is entirely treatable. Type 2 diabetes is a disease of lifestyle. And not everyone with type 2 diabetes is obese, but obesity is often correlated with insulin resistance. And insulin resistance becomes synonymous with prediabetes, diabetes, metabolic dysfunction. These are all words we use. And as I've talked about on previous podcasts, I have a podcast called Fundamental Health. There's very good evidence, and we've known this forever, that people with diabetes fare worse in influenza pandemics, flu pandemics. They fare worse with everything immunologically because proper function of the immune system depends on proper insulin signaling. Mm-hmm. And insulin resistance in the state of diabetes or prediabetes or metabolic dysfunction means that the immune system isn't going to function well.
Right.
Now, that's the problem I have with the messaging from the American Diabetes Association is like, hey, you have diabetes, hide in a cave for the next 3 months. Well, yes, but while you're hiding in that cave, figure out what in your diet is causing you to have type 2 diabetes and stop eating that.
Right.
And, you know, like, that's not the messaging. Yeah, there's a key step there. And that's one of the things I worry about with the quarantine in general is that many of us are in our homes, and hopefully lots of listeners to this program do not fall into this category, but I fear that the American public at large is more sedentary, more isolated, more lonely and is eating worse food while they're in quarantine. So we're essentially making people more insulin resistant, more likely to have complications of coronavirus when we put them in their homes. And I'll just clarify this for people. There's a little bit of nuance here around carbohydrates and insulin resistance, or carbohydrates and diabetes. Mm-hmm. I am not of the opinion that carbohydrates per se cause diabetes. When someone has diabetes, they're not going to be able to eat carbohydrates because the body won't tolerate them very well.
Right.
But for many people, insulin resistance is a combination of, this may sound radical, is a combination of vegetable oils and processed carbohydrates. There's like this colloquialism, right? Carbs, quote unquote. Well, carbs are thought to be bad. Like, I ate carbs today. Well, did you eat carbohydrates today when you ate berries, or, you know, that avocado, that avocado you're eating has 13 grams of carbohydrates. Is that carbs?
Right.
Or, you know, that squash, that butternut squash that you just ate was 45 grams of carbohydrates. Is that a problem? I don't think that's causing diabetes for most people, right?
Right.
I think that the majority of the problem is processed carbohydrates. These are grains. These are, you know, hulled, and, you know, these are highly processed flours and grains combined with vegetable oils. And I did another podcast with Kate Shanahan where I talk about vegetable oils, but it's these oxidized, primarily omega-6 oils in combination with carbohydrates that I think is both the match and the kindling and the fire starts. So what causes insulin resistance is a nuanced conversation, but it's not just that everyone needs to give up carbohydrates. If you've stopped eating all the carbohydrates, yeah, usually you become a little more insulin sensitive, but a lot of people can continue eating carbohydrates if they improve their diet overall by eliminating the processed carbohydrates and the vegetable oils.
And could you just explain real quickly why vegetable oils are so bad for us? Because I think a lot of people, I've actually seen the Heart Healthy label on vegetable oil before, and I look at that and I go, no. I mean, why exactly scientifically is vegetable oil bad versus, say, a nice olive oil or an animal fat to cook in?
Right. So this is also relevant to coronavirus. And I talk about this in the podcast with Kate Shanahan. Vegetable oil is, we're talking about things, corn, canola, soybean, peanut, safflower, sunflower. These are high omega-6 oils that have been stripped out of the actual seed of the plant and separated from everything in that oil that prevents that polyunsaturated omega-6 fatty acid from oxidizing. And again, there's a lot of big words here. Polyunsaturated fatty acids are always thrown around as beneficial, but in fact, polyunsaturated fatty acids oxidize very easily, meaning they are subject to what is called rancidity. They become rancid. They spoil very, very easily. And when the oils in our body, if we eat more vegetable oil, then more of the cells in our body are composed, or the cells in our body are more composed of vegetable oil. There is a balance between linoleic acid, which is the main omega-6 in our body, and monounsaturated oils, oleic acid, and saturated fats, which make up a large contribution of any healthy cell membrane. And if we enrich our cell membranes with too much polyunsaturated fat, that is omega-6 linoleic acid, it's susceptible to oxidation.
Right.
The more unsaturation points in a lipid, in a fatty acid, the more susceptible it is to oxidation. And this is hard to show without a diagram, but everyone listening to this should know that most healthy cells, like every healthy cell in your body, is about half saturated fat and about half monounsaturated fat and a small, small amount polyunsaturated fat. But when we eat vegetable oils, we are pushing that polyunsaturated fat percentage beyond 2-3%, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10%. When your diet is 10% vegetable oil, when your diet is 10% omega-6, when your cells are 10% omega-6, they are essentially dry wood that is just waiting for a spark to go up in a fire. They are a dead forest that is just waiting for a forest fire to blaze through it, and that forest fire is oxidation. You don't want the cells of your body to have that much omega-6 in them. That's a very dangerous thing. So that's Does that kind of make sense for why vegetable oils are bad?
It does, and because I think it's very easy, and people don't realize this, to take what would otherwise be a healthy meal and make it very unhealthy by slathering it in that stuff. And I just think it's important. I got up this morning and saw a news article that there's a shortage of frozen pizzas. Similar to the shortage of toilet paper, because that's what people are buying, you know, and that is horrible, because we're, you know, it's almost like the cure is worse than the disease in this case.
I think it is. And that's another controversial statement that I've made on Twitter and that I've made on Instagram. And that gets into many political rabbit holes and economic, you know, rabbit holes. But I don't want to minimize the death toll connected with coronavirus. This is a very serious respiratory virus that many people listening to this may know someone or have been personally affected negatively by it. And the way that we've reacted to it has caused a lot of suffering also, and will continue to cause suffering both from an economic and a health standpoint. And putting people in their homes has allowed them to watch more TV. And who is advertising on TV right now?
Frozen pizza.
exactly. Processed food manufacturers. There was an article in the New York Times that I reposted on my Instagram. Processed food sales are soaring right now because I guess people are stuck in their homes and they don't want to cook or they don't know how to cook.
Right.
And processed food manufacturers are lashing all the way to the bank.
Yeah.
And we are dealing with an epidemic that is picking off the people who are the weakest metabolically.
Right.
So we are making people weaker by keeping them in their homes. It's a challenging thing.
Yeah, you posted a video earlier today of the Venice Skate Park in California, in Los Angeles, and they were filling it with sand, which my first thought was, when this is over, how much is it going to cost the taxpayers to pull all that sand back out?
Yep.
But also just, you know, it's important that we be able to go outside. And you say there's research that shows that it doesn't really spread as well outdoors. Maybe inside of a confined building with the same ventilation system, it might spread quite well. But when you're out on a hiking trail or in a park or something like that, you're probably not going to get it from people.
I don't think you will. And I think that this is misinformation that has been perpetuated with fear and led to people wearing bandanas in grocery stores. And while I understand the intention there is to protect our fellow men and women, you're really not at risk of getting coronavirus walking down the aisle in a grocery store, passing by someone for a quarter of a second. There's a study, the indoor transmission of SARS-CoV-2, which is published in this pre-publication journal on April the 7th. People can look it up. And it was done in China. And they looked at a number of cases in China. They looked at a number of outbreaks that were related to cases. And they looked at, I think it was 1,245 confirmed cases in China. And among the identified outbreaks, only one single case transmission of 1,245 happened outside.
Wow.
The rest of them happened in indoor environments. We identified only a single outbreak in an outdoor environment, which involved two cases.
Wow.
Conclusion, all identified outbreaks of three or more cases occurred in an indoor environment, which confirms that sharing indoor space is a major SARS-CoV-2 infection risk. Now, this is what they're saying here is essentially being indoors or in a car with someone for a long amount of time in a small space is how you're going to get this infection.
Right.
That's exactly what we've always known about colds and flus.
Right, right.
But passing someone on the street, you're not going to get coronavirus. We should be allowed to be in nature. This is so silly, you know? And yeah, the chances of getting coronavirus on a beach if you're sitting by a campfire with 12 of your best friends are slightly higher. But in general, an outdoor environment is a much lower chance of getting this illness. The main problem is indoors in a small space. You're going to be fine in a grocery store.
Yeah.
I feel like in
that
general.
I feel like that might have been what happened in Italy, because they, more than so many other countries, have a couple of cultural aspects to the way that they live their lives that made them susceptible. One, there were a lot of smokers and that kind of thing. But two, they live multi-generationally. And that brings me to another thing I wanted to talk to you about, was asymptomatic cases. When we force grandma, then mom and dad, and then son and daughter to all live in a multi-generational household, the son or daughter may have it and not even know it. Grandma gets sick and dies because grandma has asthma and has smoked all her life, right? Like, I feel like that might have been what happened in Italy, because you jammed everybody into their house and forced them to stay there, and they gave it to each other.
There is a real possibility that a quarantine in Italy led to a greater loss of life.
Yeah.
Now, you could argue the reverse, that a quarantine means you don't pass it around, but putting a bunch of people in houses who are asymptomatic and can transmit it to other people, maybe that's not the best strategy either. And
right.
I don't think anyone knows what we should have done, but I hope we can learn from this for the next pandemic.
Yeah.
What's very clear is that the old smokers, people who are immunocompromised, and people who have diabetes or pre-diabetes will always be at risk for this type of thing. And so when the next one comes around, those are the type of people we want to help be as strong as possible if they want to stay alive. And that's another thing that I was talking about today. I did a podcast with my friend Kirk Parsley, which will be out on Tuesday. There is always a population, there's always a portion of the population that's going to be the most susceptible. And contrary to media reports that I believe are fear and hysteria producing, the vast majority of people who are suffering greatly with coronavirus are sadly elderly, immunocompromised, and diabetic.
Right.
That's really 99 or more than 90% of people. These reports of quote-unquote healthy people dying from coronavirus are, I really think that they're irresponsible reporting by the media.
Yeah.
Because a lot of times we don't know what underlying health conditions someone who's, quote, young could have had.
Right.
And I think it creates fear. And every single person in the U.S. now is thinking, could I die from this virus? But if you look at the data, it's overwhelmingly people who have medical comorbidities and people who are elderly. And so how do we protect them? We help them have a healthier lifestyle, but they will always be at the most susceptible space for the next pandemic.
Yeah, I think the media bears some responsibility here for the hysteria too, because, like, for instance, a perfect example, I saw a story about a woman in North Carolina, and the headline was, "I was in my house for 3 weeks and still got COVID." So the gist of the story was, she was in her house, she didn't leave the house, she never left the house for 3 weeks, and she still got it. You had to read down to about the fifth or sixth or seventh paragraph before you found out she was living in the house with someone else who had to go out and do things multiple times. And I'm like, all right, there you go. No, it wasn't. You were not isolated and still got it. It was like the whole point of the story was to drive this fear of, I could even be cowering in the basement corner, far distant room of my home and still get it. And I'm like, no, that's misleading. And the media bears responsibility for that because they have us all afraid of each other. And frankly, they have us yelling at each other if you question the paradigm as you have.
Yeah, because I think people get all triggered and they say, you want people to die.
It's yes. Like,
no. And I think that person who's saying that is either a Russian troll right. or a bot, or somebody really trying to incite, just cause division and really make people mad and just cause people to be, angry and vitriolic against each other. Because I really don't think there are many people in this situation who want people to die.
No.
I don't think anyone wants people to die.
No.
I don't want people to die. And by suggesting, as I have on social media, that perhaps now is the time to consider allowing the young and metabolically healthy to go back to work while protecting those who are elderly and vulnerable, the response that I get from some people, not all, there's a lot of support for that comment, but the response that I get from some people is, you must want people to die. That's irresponsible. How right. can you say that as a doctor? And I think, well, maybe that person and I are thinking about the paradigm a little differently. I think that this is a virus and it's very small and it moves around. And I don't think that many of us are going to be able to avoid exposure.
Right.
And that the majority of us will probably be exposed to this eventually. So if we're going to end this quarantine and we're going to end social distancing, it might make sense to consider doing it in a more calculated manner.
Right.
Because with this one, what we know is that kids don't seem to be affected and healthy people seem to do pretty darn well. So if you want to protect the elderly, maybe there's a situation in which we allow those people to get exposed and develop antibodies and either have mild symptoms or be asymptomatic and then develop some sort of quote herd immunity who knows? Right. That we have to think about how to move forward.
Well, we have to have those discussions. If we don't, we're doing a disservice by just locking down and burying our heads in the sand, you know. And I know you have to go, but there was one other issue I wanted to kind of address with this, with your medical background. And you've been watching very closely, and we have several instances that are almost like these perfect petri dishes, right? Like the Diamond Princess cruise ship, the USS Teddy Roosevelt. And these were like where all these people are stuck together. They can't go anywhere else. And then there's an outbreak on the ship. And what we're seeing is that around 60 to 80%, somewhere in that ballpark, of the people who get it are asymptomatic. And you contend, because I have compared this to the flu. And when I do, I get people that are just like, rah, you know, it's like, oh, again, you want people to die. I think this is a little worse than the flu, but looking at these numbers, it might not be that much worse than the flu. Am I wrong?
This is a very interesting charged topic. So when I say, I posted something on Twitter today that was sort of controversial, and I posted exactly something like what you're suggesting. I said, if asymptomatic rates are 60 to 80%, and there was recently a study at Stanford from John Ioannidis and Jay Bhattacharya looking at antibody prevalence, suggesting that it was a 50 to 85 fold higher seroprevalence than we expected, meaning that 50 to 85 times more people have been exposed to the virus than we are testing and showing as positive, at least in Santa Clara County, California, by Stanford. If that is true, then not only are case fatality rates between almost two orders of magnitude lower than what we are seeing now, but then it starts to look like the flu, at least in terms of overall numbers and case fatality rates. Now, the responses I got from that were, you need to go spend a day in an ICU in New York. This is not the flu.
Right.
And I'm saying, yeah, I get it. You know, this is a respiratory virus. It's killing people differently than the flu. It's not a flu virus. I get it, you know. But looking at the numbers, if we're trying to get a sense of the severity, because that's what everybody's questioning.
Right.
Right. Everybody wants to know, how bad is this virus? Is it going to kill me? Is it going to kill my son or daughter? Is it going to kill my mother or father? That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to wrangle the numbers and understand how bad is this virus. So I think that when we have those things in mind, the best estimates at this point look to see, I think you're going to see a case fatality rate between 0.3 and 0.5, which is in the same order of magnitude as a seasonal flu. Now, it could be three times worse than a seasonal flu, but it's the same order of magnitude,
right,
for the case fatality rate. And people will say, this is not like the flu. It's much worse than the flu. And we're like, well, the other thing to mention here is that if you look at the flu deaths, they're way down. Mm-hmm. Flu deaths are way down this year, as are cardiovascular disease deaths. So what's going on there?
Right.
This is the concept that when there is a virulent respiratory virus, it's going to probably target the people who are most susceptible, sadly.
Right.
And many of those people may possess comorbid conditions that would have made them susceptible to any respiratory virus.
Right.
Which is to say that when this is all said and done, the big question will be, in 2020, did more people die from respiratory viruses than in 2019?
Right.
Or were the numbers pretty much the same? That is, of the people who died in 2019 from the flu, there's going to be that group of people every single year who are most susceptible, the most elderly, right, the most immunocompromised, the most sick. Did most of those people in 2020 end up dying from coronavirus?
Yeah.
And if that's the case, we're not having more deaths. We're just seeing the deaths go somewhere where the media is having a focus on it.
Right.
And that's not to say that we're not trying to mitigate the death. I'm not trying to minimize the deaths. You
right.
know? I'm not trying to be callous. I'm just trying to say, like, look at the numbers and understand that in a given year, this is the number of people that generally die cumulatively from a respiratory virus.
Right. Well, and that's
flu deaths are down. Cardiovascular disease deaths are down.
Right.
And so people who might have died this year from heart disease may now be succumbing to coronavirus.
Yeah.
And neither of that's good. It's tragic that these people are dying from cardiovascular disease or coronavirus. But we have to think, like, what's the overall, playing field here? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does, because in other words, there, and I'm going to say it this way and it's going to sound crass, but there's a number of people who will die from coronavirus who would have died anyway, by the end of the year. And I'm not, again, I'm not trying to minimize that, but essentially because of other underlying health problems, there's probably a large percentage of the deaths of people from coronavirus who would have died within this year anyway from one of those other causes. And I think it's important, too, to point out, going back to that morbidity rate, when you said 0.3 to 0.5, if it turns out that it's that amount, and let's say I think the rate is 0.1 or 0.01 or whatever it is for the flu. And you
0.1.
Okay, 0.1. But that's with mitigation in place. So if you didn't mitigate the flu, then the flu might actually be more deadly than this. In other words, we don't have mitigation in place yet, but we will. And if it's still in the same ballpark as the flu, even without mitigation, 10 years from now, when we look back on this, we'll be like, why did we destroy the world's largest economy? There were other things we could have probably done. We could have been more prepared. We probably could have done social distancing earlier, but not as much of a lockdown. And we probably could have gotten through this.
Yeah. And I think that you're right. With the flu, we have an idea how to treat it. And I think that we don't really know how to treat coronavirus. We don't know how to treat SARS-CoV-2. We don't know how to treat COVID-19. We don't have any drugs. Remdesivir looks good. You know, for the flu, we have Tamiflu. We have other antivirals. So you're right. There is some degree medically to mitigate the flu. And the flu is not causing acute respiratory distress syndrome.
Right.
But yeah, I think that humans... I think that my concern, and this gets, I don't want to become too political.
Right.
I think this has become more of a political issue than a medical issue.
I agree.
And many of the decisions that have been made from a political perspective. And I get it. Look, I get it. I put myself in those shoes. I'm a politician. I don't want to look bad because people died. Right.
Yeah.
It's not, I mean, this gets to be too political. I apologize, but I think it's much easier for politicians to say, well, we had to do that to save lives. We had to destroy the economy to save lives. That's a much more defensible position. But it's predicated on something that we don't know is true and may actually not be true. So much of the rhetoric right now is that the original estimation were that was that 2 million people were going to die from coronavirus. And now we're saying 50 to 60,000.
Right.
Well, the party line, and I'm not taking sides here,
sure.
Conservative or liberal. I'm not taking any... I'm just saying that the messaging around this is now that we saved 2 million people, which is complete baloney.
Right.
You can absolutely not say that we've saved lives with social distancing beyond those lives that would have been lost via hospital overwhelm.
Right.
If the same number of people will get coronavirus eventually, the same number of people will die from coronavirus, whether you do social distancing or not.
Yes.
Now, the point of social distancing, as far as I've been able to figure it out, is to not overwhelm the hospital system, which I get.
Mm-hmm.
But hospitals are not overwhelmed everywhere.
Right.
In New York, sure. Chicago, New Orleans, and Detroit, yes. What do we know about those places? Well, we know New York is super concentrated. It's basically a big contagion all in itself. And New Orleans is a lot of people who are metabolically unwell. They had Mardi Gras, and they had a lot of people who are unwell. There's a lot of diabetes and a lot of poverty in both Detroit and New Orleans. And so this brings up a lot of questions, and I think that most of what's happened has already happened. It's water under the bridge, and the main thing we have to ask now is how do we move forward,
mm-hmm.
and is it time to stop the quarantine now? I think it is.
Yeah.
To protect in a way that protects the old.
Yeah, I agree. I've talked about how you could have businesses submit a plan that says, here's how we're going to keep our customers 6 feet apart. We're going to take everybody's temperature every morning. And we're going to ask the elderly to stick to the house for a little bit longer. We'll bring you what you need until we kind of get through this and our hospitals are fully prepared. But as you pointed out, if the same number of people are going to get this over time, then the same number of people are going to die. And the whole thing about the 2 million deaths, I mean, that's the old proving the negative or trying to prove the counterfactual, right? At this point, but I also think the media held or is holding our politicians to a very narrow, particular set of reactions to this virus. If any politician comes out and says, you know what, I think we need to start reopening the economy, the media says, all the people who die now lie at your feet. There is blood on your hands. And those politicians have no spine. They're not about to take that brave choice.
There's been so much rhetoric. There's so much messaging that's almost that verbatim.
Right.
The blood. I can't even tell you how often I've heard somebody say, the blood is on your hands. And it's like, wait a minute. Like, what about the blood for everyone that's going to die because we crushed the economy?
Right.
Like, whose hands is that on?
Right.
That's on your hands. You
right.
know? Like, I want to come back. And I'm not like nobody's. It's not about placing blame. It's just about thinking about it in a reasonable manner, or right. in a manner that has the correct perspective. But man, the sad fact of the matter is there's a lot of blood to go around here. You know,
yeah.
we're going to have tens of thousands of deaths from coronavirus. And frankly, I think we're going to have tens of thousands of deaths connected with economic
yeah.
catastrophe that's coming.
Well,
and
back to our original point of the conversation, how much blood is on the hands of the industries, lobbyists, and people who continued pushing these erroneous ideas about diet, you know, and it led to a nation of people who are sick with diabetes and are much more susceptible to something like this. You know, I mean, it's full circle here.
The American Heart Association recommends canola oil.
Yeah.
You know,
makes no sense.
The American Heart Association recommends a low fat, high carbohydrate diet and would gladly pat you and I on the back for eating processed carbohydrates like pasta or bread.
Grains, get that good Grains. Oatmeal, that heart healthy oatmeal in the morning.
Yep.
You know? So,
yep.
All right. So yep. before I let you go, as a medical doctor, obviously you recommend don't stop going outside. If you got a hiking trail, a park, some open space, get out there and do it. Is there anything else you would recommend to people to try to stay safe from this as we try to work our way through how we're going to deal with it?
I mean, I think that's actually that's a good recommendation. I would encourage people to get outside. Now, don't get arrested on your local trail. Unfortunately, you know.
Well, you live in California. I'm in a place where it's good. We're not being arrested for going.
Yeah, then go outside. You're not going to get this on a hiking trail. You
right.
need to exercise.
Yeah.
I think sun is important. I think fresh air is critical. I think it's important to continue to exercise in whatever way you're going to do it. And then I think it's also critical that we all think about our diet and think about sleep. It's just all the regular things, right?
Right.
Prioritize sleep. Think about your diet. I'm a proponent for an animal-based diet. Doesn't have to be 100% animal foods, but knowing where your nutrition comes from, knowing where the nutrients that your body uses to make a healthy, robust immune system come from is critical. And in my opinion, animal foods are an indispensable source of things like vitamin A, D, E, K2, the minerals, you know, magnesium, selenium, zinc, copper, iron, B vitamins, thiamine, riboflavin, niacin, B6, pyridoxine, B12. These are critical for the immune system, much harder to get from plants than animal foods in general. So that's what I'm recommending to my parents who are in their 70, who are 70 now.
Right.
And I do think that if you are 70 or you have people in your life who are elderly or immunocompromised, those people should be protected probably through the summer.
Yeah.
But I think that there's a reasonable possibility that we should think about getting the young, especially kids back to school, and the people who are young and truly healthy back to work, because we can protect the elderly by being exposed, by becoming asymptomatic.
That's a great point.
Or at least by having a mild course. Like, there's a real possibility here that if you and I go out and get exposed to coronavirus, we will protect our families, because once we are immune, we
right.
won't spread it. You know, now this whole asymptomatic thing is tricky. You know, you don't want to be asymptomatic and spread it to your family. But at the same time, that is how we might get herd immunity. You have the old, you know, not seeing the young very much for the next few months, and then you might be able to protect them by creating a herd immunity. There's a real possibility there. That's at least a worthwhile conversation to have.
I think it is. I think that's an interesting take. In other words, let us young, healthy people, let's get out there. We run a little bit of a risk, but we could probably deal with it. Let's protect the older people by exposing ourselves to it and then getting over it. And then we're immune, and then we can't give it to them. I think it's pretty powerful. I just want to tell people again to check out your book. It's The Carnivore Code. It's awesome. And you can go to your website. It's carnivoremd.com to find out more about you and your background and all of that, and your podcast, your weekly podcast. How did your blood numbers look? How do your blood numbers look on eating all meat? Because a lot of people will ask that. They're like, what about your cholesterol? How is that looking for you?
Right. So there's a whole chapter in my book about cholesterol. I'll tell you this much. My triglycerides are very low. My HDL is very high. My inflammatory markers are very low. my kidneys are fine, and my liver is absolutely fine. My electrolytes are fine. My thyroid is completely fine. The one number on a blood panel that will give people consternation is that your LDL will rise
right
when you eat saturated fat. But if you believe that LDL alone is the best predictor for heart disease, you're sorely mistaken.
Yep.
And in the book, I talk about this. LDL, I think the data that LDL itself is the driver of heart disease is false.
Yeah.
We do not have evidence that LDL itself is directly toxic to the endothelium or enough to initiate and propagate an atherosclerotic plaque. It is insulin resistance. Hmm. Now, insulin resistance, again, this is a huge rabbit hole, but insulin resistance is almost certainly the driving factor for atherosclerosis. There's good evidence that higher LDL can be beneficial in the setting of insulin sensitivity. And there's lots of data, I talk about all this in the book, that in elderly people, those with higher levels of LDL live longer.
Right. Yeah.
Those with higher levels of LDL live longer in elderly individuals, probably because LDL has an immune role and is protective in many ways. So that totally turns the LDL cholesterol paradigm on its head. Now, I think the confusion is that in people who are diabetic, we might see the LDL rise a little bit, but what we see is the HDL falls and the triglycerides go up. That is metabolic dyslipidemia.
Wow.
When we are thinking about cholesterol, we have to think about it as a multivariate analysis. There are multiple data points. We cannot become myopically focused on LDL. We have to think about, I don't want to talk to anybody about their cholesterol unless they're going to tell me LDL, HDL, triglycerides, VLDL, hsCRP, and fasting insulin. And everyone just gets so focused on that LDL number, and I think we've missed the boat there. There's a lot more nuance.
Yeah.
It's a completely different pattern. It's a pattern, right? It's five data points. You can't just look at one. And on a carnivore diet, every single one of those data points goes in a direction that people would say is favorable, except LDL. But in a diabetic individual, every single one of those data points goes the wrong way.
Right.
So they're completely different patterns, right? And everybody just gets hyper-focused on LDL. LDL does not cause heart disease. That is really not proven by, that is so hotly debated right now.
Yeah.
And if people are listening and they think, oh, my LDL is going to go up, it's like, look, like that is really a theory that is being heavily challenged right now.
And read the book because you back it up with science. And again, I just want people to understand that you're not just throwing out something. This is from a lifetime of research on your part. And, you know, you didn't just make this up to make money. You lived this from your walk as a raw vegan through to where you are right now. So I think it's important people understand that. And again, your website, it's CarnivoreMD, right?
CarnivoreMD. Yeah. The book has over 650 references. So, you know, the references in my book are longer than many other books, you know, like the actual book is, it's not that, I mean, it's like 300 pages, but yeah. The references, there's 650 references in the book. So I did my best to include as much science as I could. And, you know, there's a lot of articles in there. And I think that the book makes a very strong case that, hey, we need to really think hard about this LDL cholesterol paradigm. There's so much here that we're missing.
Awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on the Disruption Zone, Dr. Paul Saladino. We appreciate it so much.
Thanks for having me on.
He was awesome. And again, he's a medical doctor and he's looking at this from a 30,000 foot view, which is what we all need to start doing because the mainstream media can go into a hospital at any time and show you somebody on a ventilator and say, look, you want to open up the economy? Look at, you're killing these people, right? And it's like, no, that's not what we're saying. We're not saying let's just release the Kraken on society. That's not it at all. We want to see the numbers and the data and everything from a 30,000-foot view so we can make an honest and open and transparent decision. And right now, I agree with him. I think we are done with the shutdown. I think that we should now begin to phase back open the economy, and the sooner the better because people are dying because of the economic devastation. Whose blood is that? Whose hands are that? Is that blood on? Because it's very real blood. And I've seen articles that have popped up over the last couple of weeks that have been kind of trying to counter-argument that. But yet you had the UN report that because of the economic devastation, hundreds of thousands of children will die around the world. Whose blood is that? Whose hands are their blood on? Right? Now, look, we had to do something. I think maybe the original 2 weeks of shutdown might have been a good idea while we got our hospitals ready. But I think the most, one of the things I gleaned from this conversation that was the most compelling was Dr. Paul Saladino talking about how it's very possible that the same number of people are going to contract this disease over time and that the same number are going to die. It's just that we're going to spread it out over a longer period of time. Now, will we save lives by giving the hospitals time to ramp up so they can treat people better and give them the best treatment they can? Absolutely. But beyond that, the risk to the economy is not worth the risk to continuing on in this inevitable, forever, indefinite shutdown. And that's got to stop. The other thing that's got to stop is the people of America have got to stop biting at each other. You have to stop saying that because I'm bringing this up and talking to this doctor that I want people to die. You have to stop doing that. You have to start looking at this. I can't, it's so frustrating when I see people respond to stuff that I put up on social media, and it's just like, it's almost like I want to say, look, are you legitimately cheering for this virus? I mean, who wants to stay in their home? Well, a lot of Americans do because they have Netflix and unemployment is $600 a week. And a lot of people are making more money on unemployment than they were before. When that runs out and they don't have any food, they're going to demand to get out of the house. They're going to demand to go back to work. But you know what? They might have sat there so long that their job's not available for them anymore. And they might be worse off than they were. But they're living in this bubble, this Netflix bubble, right? As long as you have Netflix. I posted on Instagram or Twitter, or actually it was Facebook, that the two things that have been, that our elite leaders have learned about us as Americans is, number one, that as long as we have Netflix and a $1,200 check from the government and $600 a week from unemployment, we will sit at home, bury our heads in the sand, and we're afraid. We will sit at home and watch Netflix for an indefinite amount of time. The other thing they've learned about us is anyone who questions that paradigm, those people who are sitting at home will viciously and consistently attack them for questioning that paradigm. It's ridiculous. We need to get over this. And as I've been saying from the beginning, we have to fight a two-front war. We can fight for the economy and fight for the elderly and the people that are vulnerable. We can, we should, we must. We absolutely must do this war on both fronts. Anything less than that is a failure. 100%. All right. Thanks for listening. If you want to help spread the word of this podcast, share it with your friends. It's a free subscription at Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio's app. Just search The Disruption Zone and it will deliver me directly to your pocket. Yes. Google Play, also Spreaker, wherever podcasts are found, you can get this podcast. By the way, again, share it with your friends. You can follow us on Twitter. It's at Leland Show and at The Disruption, or excuse me, at Zone Disruption on Twitter. On Instagram, it's at The Disruption Zone and at Great Lelando. So you can follow us there. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, as well as Dynamics Audio Productions, who provide the music for this video or for this audio, the music for this program. And it's dxaudio.com. Thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.